Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Heather Reads the Podcast. Time to put on our sleuthing slippers, because our entry today comes from the Harlequin Intrigue series. Before we go any further, I'm going to put out a small disclaimer first. There will be descriptions of violence, as well as discussions of depression and suicide ahead. And if these are themes that are difficult for you, or that you find distressing, this might be an episode to skip. Our suspect today is Cold Case Colorado by Cassie Miles, and it was published on February 1st, 2021. It's listed as the first in the Unsolved Mysteries, but following installments, as well as entries left to come, are not written by the same author. I'm a little curious about this, because as near as I can tell, these books have absolutely nothing to do with each other, other than the fact that they all deal with cold cases. For those who are not glued to true crime podcasts like my beloved husband is, a cold case is a murder or violent crime that has gone unsolved, be it from lack of evidence, lack of witnesses, or simply the lack of technology available at the time. A famous example of a cold case would be the Jack the Ripper murders. But it's often that new technology and re-examined evidence help solve crimes that are years old. And it looks like the Intrigue series has decided that these are the perfect setups for passionate romance. Actually, to be honest, I'm not sure what the general feeling is for the Intrigue series. And I'll be upfront, I am not a mystery reader, so I am very, very much out of my wheelhouse right now. The closest I ever got to mystery books was the Cat Who series, introduced to me by my grandmother. I don't even watch CSI shows. But what I do know about mysteries is that many of the popular ones come in a long series format, like CSI and the Cat Who books. I figure a romance might start up in these books, but they touch on the will-they-won't-they trope that can span several novels. So I was interested to see how Cold Case Colorado fits a romance and a murder mystery into Harlequin's famously short novels. When I was looking through the bookstore, trying to decide which one to read next, I was drawn to this book first by the color. Yeah, it's a bit strange, but I've got a soft spot for purple, and the Intrigue books are covered in it. The next bit that stood out to me was the setup on the back. The heroine has a lot going on, it seems. She's dirt broke, trying to shake off a stalker, and living in her eccentric uncle's castle in Colorado. Yeah, castle. That's a lot of information to dump onto a potential reader to start, and there's still more, but I'll leave it for the review. Trust me, it gets wild. Our cover is quite eye-catching, though. At the very forefront is a sheriff in blue jeans. I know he's a sheriff because he has that telltale star badge on his shirt, but that's really the only clue we get. He has a rather dramatic pose, looking as though he's got an eye out for danger, and in his hands is a gun pointed at the ground. Behind him is our heroine, a woman I might describe as wispy, looking in the opposite direction of our sheriff, and clearly very worried about something. It's all superimposed onto a background featuring a rather imposing mansion, like our castle, I suppose, and a stormy sky. If that cover is anything to go by, we've got some real suspense heading our way, so let's strap in. We begin with Vanessa Whitman as she sneaks around a graveyard well past visiting hours. Her father has died, and with no money to bury him next to her mother, she's resorted to scattering a portion of his ashes next to her grave in the dead of night. She's on high alert, wary for both nighttime security and a creep who's started following her. But this is, it seems, her only option. Apparently, her family had been rich. Filthy rich, too, by the sounds of it. But as her father had wasted away from colon cancer over the last 4 years, all that money flew away, both to medical care and outlandish escapades as an old man pursued his bucket list. Vanessa, as a result, is dirt broke and homeless. She assures herself that it was worth it to see her father pass on with a smile, but to me it seems a little insane that he left her with absolutely nothing. I don't know, it just sounds a little improbable with someone with that much money hadn't even set up a trust fund for his kid. Oh, we've barely even started, and I am already raising eyebrows. before she can lay her father to rest, or rather, some of him, since the rest of the ashes are slated for other destinations, she hears feet on gravel, and while she can't see anyone, we get to learn about that stalker she picked up. He apparently follows her around, wearing a ski mask like a cartoon burglar, saying her name and pointing. She deposits the ashes as best as she can, and hears more noise coming to her. Yep, it's her stalker, and he's whispering creepy things like, "I won't hurt you," in a totally creepy voice. Vanessa is resourceful, though, and she chucks the jar that held her father's ashes at the guy. He goes down, probably more from shock than anything, and she takes the opportunity to pepper spray him right in the eyes. With him temporarily down, she bolts for her car and drives off toward the mountains. We meet up with her again 4 months later. She's completely left the city of Denver behind her and has settled into her Uncle Simon's castle near Aspen. She feels like things are finally looking up. Her uncle has hired her to ghostwrite his memoir, and she gets to live in the giant mansion rent-free. And because Simon is apparently a world-renowned chef, she's been eating some marvelous food. And there's sure to be excellent food tonight, since Simon will be playing host and chef for a dinner party at the castle. As we follow Vanessa walking through the mansion, we get some pieces of exposition about her family and how they had come into their fortune. Simon inherited the castle 12 years ago after his wife Dorothea disappeared in the mountains, and was only formally declared dead when her remains were found months later. There was a kerfluffle over the will, but Vanessa was unaware of the details, since none of it really involved her or her father. She ruminates on her current position in life, as well as where to place the rest of her father's ashes, when we run into Mona, the housekeeper. I'm not quite sure what to make of Mona. She's very matter-of-fact, if not outright blunt. When Vanessa informs her that an extra person would be arriving for the dinner party tonight, she jumps to some rather far-fetched conclusions. There's going to be one more person for dinner tonight, Sheriff Ty Coleman. Mona's reaction was unexpected. She fluttered her thin fingers in front of her lips, her eyebrows danced, and she giggled. "The new sheriff? My, oh my, is this a date?" "I've never met the man. I spoke to him on the phone when I was asking about information in the county files." For the memoir, she needed to find out more about Dorothy's disappearance and death. A sore spot for Simon, but significant nonetheless. "Anyway, I thought it would be useful to get better acquainted with the sheriff. You know, for research." "Oh, for your sake, I wish it was a date. You need to start spending time with people your own age. When I say people, I mean men." "What if she doesn't want to meet men, Mona? She's got options." As Mona leaves, promising a one-on-one introduction to the sheriff, Simon makes his first appearance. Simon is Vanessa's uncle by marriage. He married her Aunt Dorothy, with whom her father had a falling out some years ago. It's not really explained what caused the estrangement, only that it's still a sore spot. But Simon doesn't hold any grudges toward Vanessa from the looks of it. In fact, the reason for his entrance is to ensure that she properly signs the contract between them so she can begin to ghostwrite his memoir. Simon's introduction is interesting. He's impatient, pushy, and, in Vanessa's words, a narcissistic jerk. Red's a really defining color. He's described with a ruddy complexion from his love of the outdoors. He sports bright red hair and wears a red chef's coat. It's very clear that this fellow is used to people following his orders, be it in his world-class restaurant or in his home. At this moment, he is rushing Vanessa to sign the contract to confirm their arrangement for the memoir. I'd be worried about how quickly he wanted her to sign it, but she's already read a copy, so Vanessa's not nervous. After the contract is signed, Mona returns to let Vanessa know that the highly anticipated sheriff has arrived. When the sheriff stepped inside, Vanessa knew why Mona had hyperventilated at the very thought of this sexy man who was prime boyfriend material. Ty had that cowboy thing going for him, handsome, yet unassuming, although he didn't realize how gorgeous he was. Great body, probably 6'4 with wide shoulders and narrow hips. He wore jeans and a gray blazer. His dark blonde hair was cropped close, military style. He shook hands with Simon. Pleased to meet you. This is about where I'm starting to get worried that this is going to be one of those inexplicable attraction stories where the couple gets together just because. But I don't give up hope as the group participates in some small talk about Vanessa looking into old county records and Ty not yet having visited Simon's restaurant Simplicity. As Vanessa reaches out for her own handshake from Ty, though, the intensity of that casual connection surprised her. A tremor rattled along her spine like a pleasant earthquake. For a moment, she lost herself in the reflection of his gray-green eyes. Struggling to stay on topic, she said, "Maybe you've been to one of my uncle's franchises based on the Simplicity menu. They're called Simple Simons." Oh boy, I've got a bad feeling about this. Now Mona intervenes, herding Simon back to the kitchen for dinner preparation to ensure Vanessa and Ty get some alone time. No matter that Vanessa directly stated that she was only interested in a professional relationship with the sheriff when the day started, but who cares, right? The two start chit-chatting, and Vanessa pretty much just opens up that she all but ran away from Denver to get away from a stalker, because that's how I start all my conversations with some deep personal trauma. Ty opens up a bit about himself as well. He's the newly elected sheriff in Tremont County after having worked in the mountains as search and rescue. We also learned something rather important. Tremont County is just so sleepy that nothing more serious than basic robberies or domestic disputes ever happens crime-wise. So he hasn't had any forensics training. There simply aren't any homicides ever. So he hasn't been able to justify the time and expense. Boy, I sure hope nothing tragic happens tonight. Vanessa offers to take him on a tour of the house, and he happily agrees. She, for some reason, can't help but finally feels safe when she's walking around with him. I mean, sure. As they go through the tour, we catch sight of Bethany Whitman Burke, a distant cousin of Vanessa, yelling some nonsense about selling and making millions. And when Vanessa asks if she's all right, Bethany snaps at her before charging into Simon's room and locking the door. Vanessa and Ty chat a moment about how Bethany is related to her, and there's some conversation about why people like Bethany would use the Whitman name. Vanessa pretty much throws the whole lot of them under the bus. They think that there's an inheritance attached to the name, but they're dead wrong. I'm a direct descendant, and I barely have two nickels to rub together. She said while living in the family castle after having just signed a contract that was equal to more money than she would have made in 2 years as a teacher. I know teachers don't make a whole lot, but I am pretty sure you've got more than two nickels there. The tour goes on, and they catch glimpses of Simon's second wife, Chloe, and they find another dinner guest, Martha Ingram. She knows Ty, since her husband, George, is the county coroner. Martha doesn't seem to be having a good evening, though, and looks to be fretting about her husband. They leave her, and the tour takes them to the tower that held Dorothy's sewing room. After her death, Simon locked it, and no one's been inside since, according to Vanessa. The next guest that they find on the tour is Lowell Burke, Bethany's husband, and a lawyer. He also seems to be having a bit of a night himself, which he dismisses as difficulties with a client, and obviously can't indulge the details. Ty's copped senses are tingling, though, and pretty much thinks to himself that if something happens tonight, Lowell would be at the top of the suspect list. Ty even makes a mental note to ask the DEA to check into Lowell because of a drug case he's been working on. First of all, why are we already considered that something might go wrong tonight? This is just a normal night. Why you gotta lay down suspicions over nothing? Second of all, gee, I hope nothing bad happens tonight. I think this is why I don't read mysteries, I am completely flustered, and we are not even 40 pages into this thing. The last stop on the tour is one of the secret places in the castle. It's a secret passage leading from the game room to the wine cellar. Ty is thrilled, of course, and Vanessa tells him that there are a couple of other hiding spots in the castle, though she hasn't found another passage. Since it's getting close to dinner time, they head to the patio at the back of the house for drinks, and we meet more guests. There's a fair few of them, and honestly, I had a hard time keeping up with everyone that was mentioned. I'll try to list them as best I can, but I'll probably omit a couple, since they're really not all that relevant. We've already met Martha Ingram and Lowell Burke, so we don't need to worry about them for a while. And we've been introduced to Doc Ingram, the county coroner, and Keith Gable, Simon's business partner, through exposition and dialogue. There's Yuri and Macy Kirov. They've been working with Lowell on some real estate. Macy is dressed in a skimpy Amazon outfit, complete with tights, stars, and a cape. Macy's not really important to the story, but I just wanted you all to know that. Then there's Gloria Gable, married to Simon's business partner, and a model. She basically drapes herself all over Ty, being rather handsy, and I am uncomfortable. And that's it for our current cast of characters. There will be more, which is rather exhausting. I feel like every new person gets thrown at me while I'm still processing other information. I don't know if that's typical for the mystery genre, to be overwhelmed with information to confuse readers who are trying to work out the murder, but I'm not exactly a fan of the way it's done in Cold Case Colorado. I kept finding myself flipping back through pages, trying to parse out what actually happened in the book. I'll do what I can and omit the rather unimportant ones for the review, but it's a lot. It is what it is, though, so let's keep going. Because Simon is an absolute dictator when it comes to his dinner parties, he demands everyone be in their assigned seats no later than 8 o'clock. So when Bethany isn't present, he demands to know where she is. Mona offers to go look for her, Ty volunteers to go with her, and Simon is angered when he learns that Bethany is locked in his room of all places. Mona leads them up to the bedroom door, tries and fails to entice Ty into kicking the door in when Bethany doesn't answer, and unlocks it with her collection of keys into the house. Simon tries to go into the room, but Ty pulls rank on him and enters instead, locking the door behind him. And behind the bed, face down on the floor, with matted and bloodied hair, is Bethany. Ty wastes no time to examine her body. He determines that she was killed by blunt force trauma, and I was not prepared for the description of, and I quote, white bone fragments and brain tissue smeared in her blonde hair. He continues his cursory examination, mentally frustrated that he hadn't taken those forensic classes after all. He also finds a locket gripped in Bethany's fist, and instead of leaving it alone like he should have, he puts it in his pocket. I am certain that removing and withholding evidence from a crime scene is a crime in of itself, but what do I know? I am definitely not the county sheriff. Ty is jumping into crime-solving mode and gets in touch with his dispatch, who informs him that the Colorado Bureau of Investigation has already been contacted by Simon, which I think is pretty premature. No one actually knows that Bethany's dead yet, since Ty went into the room alone and closed the door. She could be sick, or passed out, or just playing a giant temper tantrum and refusing to answer anyone. My best guess is that this is a clue for the readers to get us suspicious of Simon as a potential suspect. If it is, I'm not moved by it very much. Simon has already been established as hot-headed, and he's probably paranoid enough to jump to the worst conclusions, and rich enough to get away with wasting the CBI's time. Ty orders all of his deputies to the castle so they can assist in the investigation, and we can finally get this show on the road. Ty still doesn't reveal what happened to Bethany, but he directs Mona to keep all of the house staff at the castle, and then for some strange reason he grabs Vanessa and takes her back into the room. To his credit, he does think to ask if she's squeamish, but that's only after he's taken her inside and closed the door. She thinks he brought her in the room because she's a suspect, but he assures her that she's the only one he doesn't suspect. After all, they both saw Bethany run into the room, and it's assumed that she had her skull bashed in while they were on the tour. Instead, Ty has asked Vanessa to help him organize the staff, the dinner guests, and to direct the deputies. She also volunteers to help take statements, since she's already prepared an interview space in the library with recording equipment for Simon's memoir. Okay, no. First of all, no. Mona has already gone off to wrangle the staff, so Vanessa wasn't needed there, and Ty has all the authority he needs to keep the dinner guests from leaving the scene, especially as his deputies are arriving. And she has neither the training nor the authority to be taking anyone's statements. Second of all, no! Anyway, before they really get into the thick of it, Ty shows Vanessa the locket, which, according to her, contains a photo of Dorothy when she was Vanessa's age. Ty puts it back into his pocket, because I guess nobody else needs to see it, and sends Vanessa off to meet his deputies. Alone in the room, he gets in touch with the CBI contact, Agent Morris, and all but throws the case out of his jurisdiction, offering any assistance that he can offer. Yeah, like he's not going to regret that or anything. The next chapter starts with Vanessa sitting in the library, waiting to interview her first subject, and I am already holding all the horses I can manage after that barn break. Because I can't stress enough how much Vanessa does not belong in this process. She is not law enforcement. She is not a lawyer. She is not in any way trained to question witnesses, let alone suspects. Why, oh why, is she permitted to even be in this room? I will tell you. Because the author is trying to evoke impressions of Agatha Christie and the era of dinner murders and amateur detectives, those bygone days where modern forensics and investigation were just getting started and criminal masterminds could be thwarted by a determined detective and his plucky gal assistant. I am not mad that the author is playing homage to the murder mystery dinner. It is popular for a reason. I am mad because she has done it in an environment that doesn't lend itself well to such theatrics. With today's high-tech forensic capabilities and lawyers on speed dial, this scenario doesn't work. I could have read this exact same story with the exact same set of characters, but set 100 years back, and I would not have been screaming the way this book makes me scream now. I could go on for hours about how literary context matters, but that is a tangent left for another time. And I'm willing to give Vanessa some slack. Maybe she's just helping run the recording equipment while Ty or someone else interviews the subjects. But no, she is straight up interviewing them herself, asking them questions and taking notes, and Ty isn't even supervising her half the time. Oh, and one more thing. She's also obsessed with note-taking and making lists, which I guess is meant to justify all this. Like, it's a whole thing, and I'm not buying it. So while they wait for CBI to arrive, they start with preliminary interviews conducted by Vanessa, and our first contestant is Keith Gable. And I'm a little shocked that a guy as high status as Keith doesn't have a lawyer present while this goes down. He tells her about his night, about trying to add some stuff to the simple Simon menu, to vague shrugs of bathroom breaks and some good old-fashioned sexism, when he accuses Vanessa of trying to catch Ty's eye when she changed out of her dinner clothes into something more alluring. By which I mean jeans and a shirt that also happens to have a V-neck. Okay. He also describes having to leave the kitchen to check on bread being baked somewhere else in the castle, and having to get a clean chef's jacket when he got hit by cherry compote by an assistant. He also insists that if he were a murderer, his choice of weapon wouldn't be blunt force, but rather poison. Yeah, that's not suspicious. The next suspect is Martha Ingram, who sniffles and appropriately cries about Bethany's murder. She mostly rambles about nonsense, but drops some interesting gossip while assuring Vanessa that she doesn't participate in gossip swaps. Rumor has it that Bethany was having an affair, and likely, with a married man, though no one knows who it is. This opens up a possible motive, and Martha has served her purpose, apart from more sniffling about how there's no way her own husband George wouldn't cheat. Oh boy. They take a small break from the interviews to think on which of the women would be strong enough to bludgeon poor Bethany to death, and while Ty is explaining why he ceded jurisdiction to CBI for the investigation, why aren't you letting them do the interviews then? There's a rather random moment of attraction for Vanessa. Ty approached her, placed his hands on her shoulders, and gazed into her eyes. We have to cooperate with these guys. They're experienced. They've got the tools and know how to use them. Their physical connection felt warm and secure, calming and exciting at the same time. Her natural inclination was to glide her hands around his torso and pull him toward her until they made full body contact and melted against each other. Inappropriate? Totally. She tossed her head and forced a smile. I'll get back to my interviews. Not a good idea, he said. I shouldn't have given you the assignment in the first place. You're not a cop. I shouldn't have put you in danger. Oh, you're just now figuring that out? Oh, I gave Crown Prince's bot bride a lot of crap for the couple are both completely attracted to each other without reason or explanation trope, but this really cuts the cake. I already wasn't sold on romances going alongside one-shot murder mysteries, and it looks like I'm not going to be. Moving on. Our third candidate is the most likely suspect, according to Ty, which basically screams to me the guy is innocent. It's Lowell Burke, Bethany's poor husband, and the way the interview goes, I'm guessing the author is going for one of two scenarios. The first one being that we're supposed to pick up on the fact that he's a red herring, meant to distract us from the real suspect, and we can immediately rule him out. The second is we are being led to believe he is the murderer. He's already on shaky ground, what with him being a scorned lover and a lawyer who would know his way around the law to get away with it. And he's described in such a way that we are supposed to immediately distrust him. Lowell Burke entered the library. Ty tried to work up a decent amount of empathy for the recently widowed man, but couldn't get past his prissy attitude or his narcissism. An hour ago, when Ty had informed Burke that his wife was dead, the well-dressed lawyer reacted with a credible display of shock. His knees folded, he collapsed into a chair and slouched over, holding his head in his hands. His cheeks were wet with tears. When he wiped his face with a tissue, it was obvious that Burke was wearing makeup, a trend Ty hoped wouldn't catch on. A lot of men wanted to look like they'd just come from the golf course or from shussing down the slopes on a perfect spring day, but they didn't take part in sports. Instead, they used spray tans or foundation makeup. Burke had taken the time to repair his mottled cheeks, creating a smooth mask that wasn't fooling anybody. His level of tension was through the roof. If twisted one notch higher, the nervous lawyer might explode. He changed his shirt and trousers. Ty made a mental note to have one of his deputies locate the clothes Burke had been wearing earlier and check for bloodstains. Okay, so there's a lot to unpack here. To start, men can wear makeup if they want, Ty. Women have been using makeup for centuries on their faces so they can look the way they want and present a certain ideal. It is 2021, and I think we can agree that men should be permitted the same luxury. To follow this, Ty has already decided that the guy is guilty as the day is long. I don't know how a person would be expected to act after they've learned that their wife was brutally murdered, but I think nervous would be on the list of normal emotions. And I am not sure why anyone was permitted to change clothes anyway, since that could be seen as a disposal of evidence if the clothes weren't immediately collected after the fact. Finally, back to that makeup. I bet dollars to donuts that it's meant to be interpreted as Lowell being untrustworthy. He's technically wearing a mask, you see, and clearly has something to hide. Paired with the change of clothes, the impression I am getting is he is supposed to go to the top of the suspect list. So, yeah, with all of those narrative clues, I am either supposed to nail my suspicions on Lowell as being the murderer or to dismiss him as an obvious red herring. It's also possible that I am supposed to wonder if the author is trying to subvert both tropes, so I keep second-guessing evidence as it grows. But really, all this scene has done is make me hate Ty for being a judgmental asshole. Vanessa starts the interview and pretty much botches it immediately when she says Lowell doesn't need to call a lawyer yet, which is pretty much when I'd get on the phone and do exactly that. He describes talking with Keith and his clients Macy and Yuri, since, you know, he was doing some real estate legalities for them. Vanessa asks if that was the reason Bethany had gone into Simon's room screaming about millions of dollars, but Lowell brushes it off. He insists that she was probably thinking about Dorothy's estate and an expected inheritance payout. He leaves, and Vanessa and Ty keep talking about him and throwing jabs at his expense. Aw, poor Lowell. Dude just lost his wife and they're making fun of him. Their conversation shifts to Bethany's obsession with Aunt Dorothy and to Dorothy's disappearance 12 years ago. As far as Vanessa knows, Dorothy had been out on a horse ride in the mountains and simply failed to return home. Because a blizzard had come through the mountains, none of the search and rescue efforts were successful until spring. There were no signs of foul play, or at least that's what she was told. Rumors abound about her death, though, ranging from horrible accident to murder victim at Simon's hand for insurance money. Vanessa's convinced that Simon's innocent, but she's prepared that she may find some ugly secrets for her work on Simon's memoir. Macy is their next subject, but the book doesn't go into her interview or any of the others from this point on. So that gives us our three main suspects: Simon, Lowell, and Keith. Their story pretends to give Gloria and Macy some possible motives and ability, but I'm certain we can rule out anyone besides these three men. Vanessa heads to her room for the night and wonders if Bethany's had actually been murdered for a supposed affair, or was it related to Dorothy's disappearance? I mean, when they lay it out like that, it's obvious that its answer is yes. As she's pondering this conundrum, she hears a voice in her room. Startled, she tries to tell herself that she's overtired, and there's no way that her stalker has followed her to Aspen and hidden himself in her room, but the voice starts up again, telling her that he won't hurt her, and to look out to the Hag's Stone, which is a rock outside on the property. I guess it looks like a hag. Vanessa does as the voice says, good idea, and when she looks outside, there he is in all his ski-masky glory, her stalker pointing at her window. After she's gotten over the initial shock, as well as wonder if he had been the murderer, Vanessa wastes no time in deciding to do something stupid. Before she could reconsider, she thrust her feet into sneakers and covered her pajama top with a denim jacket. In the back of her underwear drawer, she found a small flashlight. Her canister of pepper spray was also in there, but she decided she wouldn't need it. This time, she wouldn't confront her stalker alone. She had Ty on her side. At least she's trying to get a chaperone for her field trip, but the choice not to arm herself? Yeah, no. As she's trying to call Ty, she runs into him anyway as he's patrolling the house, and she informs him that her stalker was here tonight and that they've got to go now if they have any hope of catching him. Ty attempts to be reasonable and insists that she stay behind while he checks it out, but Vanessa seems intent on chasing down a murderer tonight. She threatens to go on her own, but he relents, and together they head outside. Ty does accept that it was a good idea to bring her, since she's able to pick her way across the landscape towards the Hag's Stone, and tells her as much. They reach the ledge where the stalker had been standing, and they carefully survey the area for anything suspicious. Ty is lucky, and he finds a glove, which to them looks rather nice and expensive. They determine that the stalker must have been one of the people at the house. Who else would have known how to get to the Hag's Stone or where her bedroom was? Ty is all but certain that the murderer and the stalker are one and the same, and asks Vanessa how many enemies she has. She insists that there aren't any in her squeaky clean past as a high school teacher and caretaker for her father's final years. Vanessa looks around the stone and back at the house, and something takes her attention. The light is on in Dorothy's sewing room, the one that had been locked for the last 12 years. Ty calls one of his deputies in the house to investigate, but unfortunately, they're too late to catch anyone. And at this point, Vanessa is completely vexed why all this was happening to her, and why did it all seem to come back to Dorothy? And while I'm sitting here wondering exactly that, Vanessa decides to be impulsive. She reminisces about her father. No, really, I am dead serious here. And wishes she could be more spontaneous. So she decides to embrace spontaneity and kiss Ty right then and there. And that, sadly, is where I have to leave it for now. It's been so difficult to summarize the story, what with all its convoluted turns and info dumps, that I've barely been able to get past a third of the story, and this review is almost nearly as long as my last two. So we will have to return to Cold Case Colorado in our next episode. Thank you for joining me, dear listeners. Make sure to tune in for the next episode of Heather Reads, the podcast, for the stunning conclusion. We'll have to see, I guess. Like the show? Please visit us at heatherreads.com for more. That's HEATHERREADS.com. If you have any questions or just want to say hi, you can email us at podcast@heatherreads.com. And remember, it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.